just lobbing us up with thugs who murder, you know, racist thugs, white supremacists who murder innocent people. And then they paralleled Bill Cosby to Emmett Till, and now they're paralleling Bill Cosby to Jesus Christ. I mean, this is not only blasphemous, it just shows the profundity of their depravity.
And we just have 10 seconds, yes. But what this means for Andrea Constant, you as women stood together during this trial.
Yeah, Andrea Constant is the Joan of Arc in the war on rape. She has an outstanding family who has just held her up with tremendous strength and unity, and I just think she's going to go down in history.
Judge O'Neill said to Andrea Constant, "You took her beautiful young spirit and crushed it. No one is above the law. No one should be treated differently or disproportionately," he said to that to Bill Cosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. That was Lily.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at PCC Cascade in Portland. Kathy will speak on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, finding hope in countries devastated by U.S. policy. Her particular focus helps expose the direct impacts of U.S. policies, including sanctions, war, drones, and military support for warring parties. Again, that's Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Warning, the following message is only for listeners who contributed during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. If you did not contribute to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, please turn off your radio now.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
If you didn't contribute during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, you may now turn your radio back on.
It's not too late. Go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution right now.
Then the next time this spot plays, you'll be able to listen.
It's a couple minutes past five, and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years. Serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council formally appointed the 13 members of the city's newest Civilian Police Oversight Board.
We'll have an update on the Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination.
And in international news, Mexican authorities have disarmed the entire Acapulco police force, with Army and State Police taking over law enforcement functions in that resort city.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 26, 2018. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. There were 10 heroin overdoses in Eugene, Springfield between Saturday and Monday. During an 8-hour stretch on Saturday, five people overdosed in Springfield. All five were saved by Narcan, a drug that cancels the effects of a heroin overdose. This led Springfield police to warn the community of an exceptionally strong strain of heroin, potentially laced with fentanyl, currently on the streets. Five more heroin overdoses were reported on Monday in Eugene and Springfield. Yesterday, Lane County Public Health reported 21 emergency room visits related to heroin overdose during the weekend, which is triple the average.
City Council today formally appointed the 13 members of the city's newest Civilian Police Oversight Board. A number of KBOO reporters were at City Council today. Sam Bowman has this report with additional reporting by Carly Meisberger, Jasmine Moneymaker, and John Reinmiller.
City Council covered a small clutch of business this morning, with their main focus falling on two items: amending marijuana business regulations and appointing 13 community members to the new Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, or PCEP. The changes to pot business regulations included implementing the city's social equity program. Practically speaking, the changes mean that licensing fees will be lowered for smaller cannabis retailers and producers, as well as some revenue from those fees and taxes being directed into a record expungement program for individuals with minor pot infractions in their background. However, the topic that hovered over and ran beneath the morning session was policing. More specifically, community policing. What does it mean? What does it look like? What do people expect? During communications, when community members can speak to council on any topic for 3 minutes, three members of East Portland's Park Rose neighborhood said that they wanted more cops to respond to issues with crime and people living outdoors in their area. In this exchange, Park Rose Business Association President Angie Jenkins expresses her exasperation with the limited police response in their area and prompts a response from Mayor Ted Wheeler.
So the question I always have is, what should we be doing that we are not doing? Resources, the finite resources we have.
I need you to enforce the laws.
Okay, so
I need you to address the behavior. So if somebody has mental health issues, there's resources for that. But if they're, how in the world can I take a video of a drug deal, of heroin, going down? I call the officers and they say, oh, that's just a little bit of heroin.
Okay, well, first of all, let me address that issue. Using or dealing heroin is against the law. I want you to hear from me. If a police officer or a firefighter ever tells you that I've tied their hands, they're not telling you the truth. And so if any, I said this the other day in a different neighborhood association meeting, if an officer ever tells you that, get their name. I want to know.
For today's purposes, we should move on to the PCEP. KBOO will be covering the ongoing rollout of the city's newest civilian police oversight body over the coming months, so today we will mostly limit ourselves to introducing the new members. 7 of the 13 appointees were present in council chambers this morning and were introduced by the mayor's senior policy advisor, Nicole Grant.
Of the 106 applications we received, the mayor has chosen to appoint the following outstanding individuals to the PCEP. For anyone interested, we have published on the mayor's website under public records the demographic breakdown of PCEP applicants. We've also included a full description of the selection process along with descriptions of the mayoral, adult, and youth interview structures. Individual demographic information about the candidates was not disclosed to the selection advisory committee during the selection process. The mayor has also selected 4 adult alternates and 2 youth alternates who are welcome to attend all PCEP meetings and the orientation.
As was pointed out by Portland Copwatch's Dan Handelman and again this morning by Commissioner Chloe Udaly, the previous Civilian Oversight Board ran through all of its 6 alternates in a matter of months before ceasing to function as a public body early last year. Mayor Wheeler expressed that he did not expect that the PCEP would need to, quote, go too deep into the pool of alternates, unquote, though he did not elaborate on this except to say that the city had consulted with members of the previous board about what went wrong. So now, let's hear from the new members of the PCEP, or at least the 7 in attendance, starting with Lakiana Drury, the director of a nonprofit that seeks to build positive relationships between African American men and law enforcement.
Lakiana Drury, executive director of Word is Bond and teacher at Rosemary Anderson High School. We're very excited to be a part of this project. I think it's very important work, and we look forward to engaging the community, and particularly for me, engaging the youth and making sure that their voice is heard in this process.
I'm Kalonji Williams, a junior at POIC and a member of Word is Bond. I'm excited to get my hands dirty, make a change, and address all the issues going on with, as far as institutional racism, all the issues PCEP is going to be participating in.
I'm Sebastian Chevalier. I'm a senior at Lincoln High School and a member of Word is Bond. I joined this work simply because I was born and raised in Portland, and I wanted to give back to the community that molded me, and I'm very excited, but I also recognize that it's not going to be easy work, and I'm ready for a tough, bumpy road.
My name is Lakeisha Dumas, born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I'm a recovering addict, and I suffer from mental health challenges, mental illness. My higher power led me to be at more tables, to be the voice and the advocate for change in this community, bridging the relationships between police and community. I've been on both sides.
Good morning.
Good morning. I am Robert Dyer, Bob Dye, a general manager of Lloyd Center. I've got a broad resume of working with various police agencies across the country just in my career. But I think what drives me more than anything is I had an older brother who was a product of the prison system. Also had mental health issues. And what I'm hoping to see come from my work with the PSEP is really just strengthening, bringing the community together.
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, Commissioners. My name's Andrew Kallick. My folks were public school teachers who were dedicated to public service, put that at the heart of our family life. And the way that's manifested in my career has been seeking justice for all manner of folks in all manner of situations, whether it was representing incarcerated folks in law school, in in-house disciplinary proceedings, or trying to fight for Social Security benefits or unemployment insurance for people.
It should also be said that Mr. Kallick is currently the America's policy manager, whatever that means, for Airbnb in Portland. And the last of the seven PSEP members to testify today was Sam Sachs.
I'm humbled to be here today as a citizen of Portland, as a community member whose family has been here since the 1940s. Currently, I'm the founder of nonprofit The No Hate Zone, focused on ending hate and racism in our community through education, community engagement, and advocacy. One of the community engagement pieces that we do, some of you know, is we have Breaking Bread, Breaking Barriers once a month, where we bring specifically focus on communities of color and police together to have dinner and sit down and have conversations.
The six members not present are Yolanda Clay, a peer support specialist in the mental health community, Sharon Gary Smith, the chair of Metro's Committee on Racial Equity and a longtime activist and nonprofit leader in Portland, Aden Hassan, a board member of Cool Islam, a Southwest Portland program for disadvantaged Muslim youth, Michelle Lang, director of campus ministries at Warner Pacific University and founder of the, quote, Art of Tough Talks multimedia project, Patrick Nolan, a board member of Sisters of the Road and Empowerment Initiatives and an advisory council member with the Mental Health Association of Portland, and finally Zachary Thornhill, an adjunct instructor at PSU and a county social worker. Stay tuned to the KBOO Evening News in the coming weeks and months as we follow the continuing rollout of the PSEP and other issues around policing and justice in Portland. For KBOO in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
What do Jim Belushi, Cypress Hills DJ Muggs, State Senator Floyd Prozanski, and U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley all have in common? Well, they're all scheduled to appear at the International Cannabis Business Conference later this week here in Portland. To find out more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke to Senator Prozanski.
Well, what I'm going to be doing is I'm actually going to be part of a panel that's going to be a Q&A on our perspective of what we believe needs to happen within the Oregon cannabis industry. You will have advocates from different perspectives of the industry there, and I will be participating in that panel discussion as a legislative member, someone that I think has been recognized as being one of the leaders, if not the leader in the cannabis area of industry, for ensuring that we can have those discussions as to, one, hearing what needs to be done from the perspective of the users of the industrial system, and also what I will believe is going to be viable for us to be looking at during the 2019 session. This is part of the area that we talked at the very beginning of our interview, looking at ways that we can deal with the diversion that has been identified, and how we can do that in a means that will actually be a positive for moving the industry forward and addressing the concerns that we currently have while we still have a prohibition at the federal level. Now, clearly, the easiest thing would be for Congress to do what they should have already done, and that is to allow for cannabis to be throughout the country. That would take away all of the diversion issues, because at that point, Oregon would be exactly where I want it to be, positioned to take product that is now being grown here, and being processed here, and actually being able to service multiple individuals throughout the country.
That was State Senator Floyd Prezanski speaking with KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh about Prezanski's appearance this Friday at the International Cannabis Business Conference here in Portland.
Students at Portland State University have organized an occupation of the campus security office to call for disarming campus security there. Teresa Mitchell visited their camp today and files this report.
Thanks. What's your name?
Caitlin Day.
And you're a media rep? You're a media rep for...
The PSU Student Union, or SUSU.
All right, and you're out here, and the occupation, I take it, has been continuous for a while. How long have you all been out here?
So we've been out here since Monday. Monday was the first day of classes, so we've been here for about 3 days, and we're going to stay indefinitely until PSU makes some movement towards meeting our demands.
Are y'all staying out here all night then?
Yes, we have been. We've been spending the night, taking shifts, doing security. It's been a mass amount of support, which is amazing.
I see that you have a lot of food and coffee donations. About how many people are involved at this point, do you think, directly?
How many people are involved in the occupation total? It's definitely fluctuated. We have about 10 core organizers who plan this event, but since then we've been getting about 20 or 30 people come by throughout the day, donating food, helping out, passing out propaganda. So it's definitely fluctuating, but I would say anywhere from like 10 to 30 at any given time.
I see that you have tents here. Do you know about how many people are staying in tents?
From the past couple nights, it's been about 10 to 15 people who have been spending the night. Some people have been sleeping on the sidewalks, and some people have been sleeping in the tents, and some people have been actually just staying up and keeping watch.
Give me the basics. So what brings you out here, and what do you hope to gain?
We're out here today and for the rest of the week and indefinitely because our campus police are armed, and that was after pushback from students and faculty and staff who did not want this decision to happen. The decision was made in 2014, and the officers were officially armed in 2015. We were against this decision for a variety of reasons, especially because of the history of police violence against black and brown bodies and against homeless people in the community who were being swept off campus by security. And it all culminated this summer when campus security shot and murdered a black man named Jason Washington. And ever since then, we have been mobilizing to reignite the Disarm PSU campaign. We're demanding for officers to be disarmed, the officers who were involved to be fired, which was Officer Dewey and Officer McKenzie, and to also install a permanent memorial for Jason Washington that is led by the family.
This brings to mind how many white people have been effectively disarmed by the cops even when they are brandishing powerful weapons. So it is the race angle that brings you out here.
Yes, definitely a big one. It's the race angle, but also there is a lot of intersections with homelessness, of people being swept off campus. There's intersections with queerness. There are many queer students, especially trans students, who feel uncomfortable with the guns. So it really is a lot of intersections between different oppressions, but race is a huge one, and especially in the case of Jason Washington.
I understand Mr. Washington's family endorses this effort.
Yes, they do. They have supported us fully, which is amazing. They're incredible people.
Are you getting good reactions from passersby?
For the most part, yeah. I've only seen a few people who have come by and maybe said that, no, we need cops, but usually they either walk away or we're able to have an all right conversation with them. But the support has been overwhelming. It's been supported by media. It has been supported by passerbys. Faculty have been supporting it, talking about it in their classes. We've seen our t-shirts and buttons everywhere. It's incredible, and it's definitely ignited a huge conversation.
What would a campus security effort look like if you were successful in your efforts?
If we were successful in our efforts, well, first we'd see the officers being fired, and next we'd want to see that our police are actually disarmed, and so we would want to effectively go back to what it was before they were armed, where it was just a campus security office, and look at different ways of how safety can look on campus. We'd want to see an emphasis on de-escalation and trauma-informed responses to crises, and we'd also want to see an emphasis on having a compassionate response to houseless people on campus that doesn't involve policing and sweeping people off of campus.
Referring to the specific incident that triggered this, I understand that the police officers who were involved in the shooting are now here on campus with desk duty?
Yes, they are on desk duty right now, but they still have their guns.
Have they had any comments to you? Have you seen them?
We have not seen them specifically. We've seen officers walk by. We do have a general rule at camp, though, to not engage with the officers and not to talk to them. So for the most part, it's just been them walking past us, maybe saying hi.
You've had some media coverage?
Yes, we've had quite a bit of media coverage, which has been incredible, and it just continues to spread.
What would you say to KBOO community radio listeners?
We want everyone to know that we'll be posted up here outside of the CPSO office on campus.
That's at Broadway and Broadway and Montgomery.
Yes, we'll be on Broadway and Montgomery hanging out, and we appreciate any support from the community because we recognize, although this is a student-led effort and we're very proud of that, this is also affects the entire community, and we want the community to come out to support this.
And I see donations that appear to be, those are pink boxes, and you have donations from Starbucks, and who else?
There are actually donations from Coco Donuts right across the street. Beforehand, we talked to our neighbors, Green Zebra and Coco Donuts, and they said they support us and have been donating food.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For KBOO Portland, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley filed a federal lawsuit today to delay the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. The complaint alleges that the level of interference and obstruction with the Senate's efforts to review Kavanaugh's record violates the Constitution's advice and consent clause. Merkley is asking for an injunction to stop the process until the Senate receives thousands of documents from the National Archive that relate to Judge Kavanaugh. Those documents may not be ready until late October. Also today, New York Senator Chuck Schumer asked Kavanaugh to withdraw his nomination in light of the sexual allegations that have been made against him. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford is still scheduled to appear before the Senate Judicial Committee tomorrow, but Republican senators won't be questioning her. They're bringing in Rachel Mitchell, a sex crimes prosecutor from Arizona, to do the grilling. Regardless of the testimony they hear on Thursday, Republicans have already scheduled a committee vote on the Kavanaugh nomination for Friday morning. A second Kavanaugh accuser, Deborah Ramirez, has not changed the Senate's schedule, nor did today's affidavit filed by Julie Swetnick. Swetnick is represented by Michael Avenatti, who is also Stormy Daniels' attorney.
Tune in tomorrow morning on KBOO when we'll be running the live coverage by Pacifica Radio of the confirmation hearing for Brett Kavanaugh before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford will be present at the hearing to present her accusation of attempted rape. The hearing begins at 7 a.m. Pacific time, and we will be broadcasting from then until 11 or until the top of the hour after the hearing ends, whichever comes first. Coverage will be hosted by Pacifica's Antonia Juhas and Mitch Jezerik. So once again, tune in to 90.7 FM at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning or go to kboo.fm to listen to live coverage of the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearing.
The only thing that doesn't surprise KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is surprises.
Don't be fooled by certainty. Your friends, your own, Amy Goodman's, the Oregonians. Only thing I'm certain of is surprises, like our temperatures jumping back into the 80s to end September. Sure, some things go as expected. The uber-privileged Kavanaugh abused a few women. Trump got laughed at by the United Nations. Newt Bueller's path to the governorship is paved with $1,000 bills. But Kavanaugh could withdraw. The UN could leave New York. And who's Oregon's next governor depends on who votes, an unpredictability the powerful keep working to control. Sometimes not voting for a candidate who's good but not great becomes a vote for a candidate you probably hate, because the system's binary. Voting is usually one or the other. Of that, I'm certain and very ready to be surprised. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's The Underground, covering a wide range of issues affecting American youth, including school activism and local events. That's followed at 7 by Combined Culture Radio, a show whose mission is to help inspire and spread knowledge to the community around us. Tonight's weather, clear with a low of 56. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 83. Today in history, in 1960, the first televised presidential debate was held. The Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy, went up against Republican Vice President Richard Nixon. Television viewers thought Kennedy won the debate, while those who only listened on the radio favored Nixon. The quote of the day is from special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox, who said, "A free society depends upon a high degree of mutual trust. The public will not give that trust to officials who are not seen to be impartially dedicated to the general public interest, nor will they give trust to those high in government who violate the rule of law they ask citizens to obey at the expense of self-interest, or to those who present government as the place where one feathers his own nest or exchanges favors with friends and former associates."
Black History 365 celebrates the achievements, milestones, and honors the history of African Americans every day of the year.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is September 27th. On this day in 1827, African-American minister, politician, and college administrator Hiram Rhodes Revels was born. Revels became the first African-American to serve as an elected Mississippi senator in the Congress during the Reconstruction era. He was also a minister of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the oldest independent Protestant denomination founded by African-Americans in the world.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
The FBI released its annual Uniform Crime Report on Monday. According to the feds, there were fewer reported violent and property crimes in 2017 compared with 2016. More than 1.2 million violent crimes were reported to law enforcement in 2017, a decrease of just 0.2% from the previous year, and a more than 10% decrease from 2008. Nearly 7.7 million property crimes were reported to law enforcement in 2017, a drop-off of 3% from 2016 and more than 20% lower than that figure from 2008. Authorities were only able to clear less than half of those violent offenses and less than a fifth of the reported property crimes. Clearing a crime does not mean that someone has been found guilty, only that a person has been arrested, charged, and turned over for prosecution. Justice Department surveys of crime victims show that less than half of the violent crimes committed each year and less than 40% of property offenses are ever reported to law enforcement. Altogether, law enforcement in the U.S. made more than 10.5 million arrests in 2017. Of those, just over 500,000 arrests were for violent crime, and nearly 1.25 million arrests were for property crimes. Drug offenses represented the biggest category of arrests, with more than 1.6 million of those. That's the largest number of drug arrests since 2010. More than 85% of those arrests were for simple possession of a controlled substance. In spite of the growing number of states that have legalized or decriminalized marijuana in the past few years, there were almost 600,000 arrests for simple possession of marijuana in 2017. That's an increase from the previous 2 years.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2007. It was that morning that a bridge under construction in Vietnam collapsed. The disaster happened in Kinh Tao, about 100 miles south of Ho Chi Minh City. It was a suspension bridge project to cross the Hao River. The project was run by Japanese firms working with the Vietnamese government. 250 workers were on site at the project when the disaster happened. 55 people were killed, and another 100 were injured due to the collapse. One reason cited for the collapse was that torrential downpours had caused the support structure for the bridge to sink. Another possible reason was that the scaffolding on the construction project was too weak to hold the weight. When it failed, it took down a section of the four-lane concrete deck approach ramp with it. The fallen section weighed between 1,500 and 2,000 tons. The collapse was considered the worst disaster in the history of the Vietnamese construction industry. Man Hung, leader of one of the construction teams, described what occurred, saying, quote, "We suddenly heard a great explosion at a bridgehead. Dust covered a great airspace while workers screamed out. The scene was so terrible. The whole great block fell on people below. Vietnamese, along with Japanese and Filipino rescue volunteers, rushed to attempt to find survivors. 1,000 local residents gave blood at the hospital for those injured. The rescue efforts were hampered by the danger of a further collapse. They had to use a crane to clear the rubble. Finally, after four torturous days, the rescue efforts were called off. The bridge project was completed in 2010. The names of the fallen workers are inscribed on a memorial." Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A delegation from Alaska is in Washington, D.C. this week, joining others in publicly expressing their opposition of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Tribal leaders and members of grassroots groups are speaking out about allegations of sexual misconduct against Kavanaugh, saying it's especially concerning with the high rates of abuse Native women across the country face. Adeline Raboff from Arctic Village is part of the group protesting.
Not okay, especially considering all the terrible sexual abuse that Native American women suffer in America. And I think that this rising awareness about this and people not hiding about these facts anymore, I think these are really important steps in our national consciousness.
Native people are also raising concerns about the nominee's view on Native rights. In Alaska, Raboff says land, subsistence, and protecting culture are of top concern, and the group is taking their message to members of Congress. On Tuesday, Kavanaugh protesters were arrested outside Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan's office. Regina Randall from Anchorage was among those arrested. She says it was a peaceful protest where they sang songs, shared their stories, and wanted the senator to hear their concerns.
We have more power than we know, and we just need to come together, and we can make magic happen. And we need to stand up for our rights and for ourselves, but in a good way.
In a statement, Sullivan said the group was listened to respectfully and that his office did not call police. Two crime victim advocates based in Montana were honored by the state's top law enforcement official. The two women received special recognition for helping those who live on the Northern Cheyenne and Crow reservations. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio reports.
The Northern Cheyenne Reservation is a special place for FBI agent Aaron Harris.
This is where my grandparents are going to be buried. This is where I'm going to live forever.
Harris, an enrolled tribal member, says violence against Native women is not new. What is new is the attention largely because of social media. Harris is one of the FBI's crime victim advocates. Her job is to connect victims with support services and help them navigate the judicial system.
I know that, being a victim of a crime is not their best moment, but that we want to meet them where they are, and we want to be able to help them get justice and get that in a way that they feel believed and respected, and in a way that that justice is served and that that crime doesn't happen to somebody else.
Harris and Michelle Stewart are the primary organizers of two multidisciplinary teams in Indian Country. They were honored by the U.S. Attorney for Montana and the State Attorney General as Outstanding Advocates of the Year. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
This week, a federal appeals court sided with North Dakota in a voter identification case blocking expanded proofs of ID, the Associated Press reports. Native American voters see the need for tribal addresses, such as P.O. boxes, to prove residency, and the use of tribal documents, letters, or enrollment cards for identification at the polls. Native Americans are suing the state over its voter ID law, claiming it's discriminatory. State officials say it would cause problems and could lead to fraud. Attorneys say they plan to continue to fight for Native voters in the state. The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs will examine juvenile justice during an oversight hearing in Washington, D.C. Wednesday afternoon. The hearing will focus on a report on Native youth involvement in the justice system and look at ways to address juvenile delinquency. Tribal and federal witnesses are expected to testify. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It is 5:34, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
War is hell. We've learned that over and over from the hundreds of thousands of deaths, uncountable maimings, torturings, wastings, and other horrors our soldiers have experienced in the multitude of wars in this century alone. America is now militarily involved in 76 countries. Yet the war machine, including a massive army of profiteering corporate contractors and the politicians they buy, keeps demanding more. More troops, more money, more profits, more war. Finally, we the people, the 90-plus percent of us who are not really aware of, much less engaged in, this hell, need to awaken to another stark reality. War is stupid. The place to start admitting it and to begin ending the stupidity is 8,000 miles away from us. Quote, "It is time for this war in Afghanistan to end." That's not me talking. It's General John Nicholson, who has served four tours in that war and recently completed 31 months as the commander of our forces there. After 17 years, the longest war in U.S. history, after 2,202 Americans killed there, after trillions of dollars frittered away, after multiple policy shifts that falsely promise victory, it's widely conceded by our own military that we can't win. In fact, the war is such a low priority that Trump, the commander-in-chief, has never even bothered to meet with General Nicholson. Yet we have 14,000 troops stuck there, are pouring more blood and treasure into the lost cause every day, continue to prop up the inept and wholly corrupt Afghan government, and are destroying our nation's credibility as a global force for peace and democratic values. Why? Another former commander of U.S. forces answered with depressing candor, "We continue to fight simply because we're there." This is Jim Hightower saying, did I mention that war is stupid? If we're only there because we're there, it's way past time to leave.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, six tribes are collaborating on a massive project that could break ground as soon as 2020.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Six tribes in South Dakota are working together to harness one of the region's most abundant natural resources.
It's really windy here.
That's Daniel Gargan of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. His tribe, along with five others of the Great Sioux Nation, are partnering on the Ocheti-Shakowi Power Project.
The whole point was to get the tribes together to pool their resources to build the wind farms of a size that the power could be sold on the wholesale market.
The project should break ground in 2020, and when complete, will produce 1 gigawatt of electricity. That's enough to power more than 500,000 homes. Gargan says the wind power project will generate revenue and provide jobs for the tribes. But they're motivated by more than just money.
We really believe that we are stewards of our climate, stewards of our environment. We're focusing always on 7 generations down the road in the future to try and take care of the babies yet unborn and to provide the health and welfare for our tribal people.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Visitors to Virginia State prisons will not have to remove tampons or menstrual cups when visiting inmates, at least not yet. The recent policy was suspended last night after a national wave of protest. Under the policy, prisons had planned to offer pads as an alternative to visitors who were wearing tampons or would have been permitted to instead wear a pad brought from home. Visitors would then have received a body scan for potential contraband. The policy was aimed at reducing smuggling of drugs and other items into the prisons. This regulation implies that only menstruating women are likely smugglers, said Kay Corey, a state legislator who had introduced the bill that now requires prisons to provide free feminine hygiene products to female inmates.
Mexican authorities on Tuesday took over law enforcement duties in the city of Acapulco. Federal and state agencies took guns and radios away from the local police and are running background checks on all officers. Additionally, two Acapulco police commanders have been accused of murder with warrants issued for their arrest. Officials were acting on concerns that the Acapulco police had been entirely corrupted by drug traffickers. The U.S. Embassy in Mexico issued a warning to U.S. citizens against traveling to Guerrero State, where Acapulco is located, saying that, quote, violent crime such as homicide, kidnapping, carjacking, and robbery is widespread.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 26th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Teresa Mitchell, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is David Kesters. The directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Tomorrow morning on KBOO, we will be running the live coverage by Pacifica Radio of the confirmation hearing for Brett Kavanaugh before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Again, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford will be present at the hearing to present her accusation of attempted rape. The hearing begins at 7 a.m. Pacific time, and we will be broadcasting from then until 11 or until the top of the hour after the hearing ends, whichever comes first. Coverage will be hosted by Pacifica's Antonia Juhas and Mitch Jezerik. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, we'll be running the live coverage by Pacifica Radio, as mentioned. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman welcomes Anna Moskovasis to discuss her latest book, Eleanor, or The Rejection of the Progress of Love. And at 11:30, the film show focuses its lens on the independent film scene in Portland. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
I'm going to do an intro real quick. Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to News from the Boo. This is your weekly update about what's happening in and around KBOO. And I'm very excited to be joined by Mike Fitaklis, who is our drive coordinator. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Del.
How are you?
I am great. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, and I'm really excited that the membership drive happened, that it went well, that it's done. And I just want to say thank you, huge thank you to everyone who's donated, participated, contributed, whether you are a business or individual donor, a volunteer, or a staff member. Thank you, Mike, for all your hard work.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who participated. we couldn't have done it without everyone.
Right, right. It just feels, for us, it always feel kind of like a big party that we throw, and then, you know, there's a lot of like, I don't know, maybe it's just for us.
Yeah. No, I think there were a lot of good times had. I mean, the attitude at the station was a lot more upbeat than it has been in the last couple of drives, so.
That's really great. So tell us about how much we wanted to raise, how much we raised, and what that means for people who have not yet donated.
Well, our goal was $93,500 for a 17-day drive. We are a couple days past the drive now, and we are currently at $84,900 and counting, so not too shabby. But we still need the support of anyone, especially those people who did not get a chance to contribute during the drive. I know I've talked to a couple people who said, oh, I thought the drive was still going on. So you can still contribute online at kboo.fm/give, and then you'll get to listen to my terrible spot thanking you on the air.
It's a great spot. I mean, if you have a sense of humor.
Right, yeah. But no one has a sense of humor, so.
I know our listeners have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
So, Mike, there was a lot of changes that happened that we actually implemented with this particular drive. Our desire is always to try to improve the system so that we can save as many dollars as we can having the drive, so we can actually invest those dollars into the radio. So tell us about what are some of the things that we changed this time around.
Right. So our cost per dollar raised is way higher than it should be for a nonprofit like us. And part of the reason for that is because way too much staff time goes into working on the drive. It's also just the case that we suffer consistently from data quality and from too much work in the aftermath of a drive, whether it's for volunteers or for staff. And it's much less of a hassle to automate a lot of our data entry process, not to mention it gives us better data. So one of the measures that we took in this last membership drive was we were using computers to enter donations directly into a web form. We were bypassing the pledge process for the most part, and we were processing payments immediately. So not only does this